This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Most of us have a picture in our head about what the perfect learning environment looks like and sounds like. Secluded, comfortable, quiet. Yeah, that's pretty much all wrong.
It turns out none of those are true. There is no one ideal way to learn.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to the author of the book, How We Learn, and learn why most of us get it all wrong. We'll also hear from a student in the Northeast who's always being asked, where are you from? And we'll spend an academic minute mourning the loss of the roadside motel. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Just about everything you know about learning is wrong. That's the big takeaway from Benedict Carey's book, How We Learn, The Surprising Truth About When, Where, and Why It Happens. Carey is a science reporter for the New York Times who focuses on topics concerning the brain and behavior. We spoke about his book, which was recently released in paperback. I loved the first line of the review that Scientific American Mind gave your book, saying it was a gift to guilt-ridden slackers everywhere. Thank you for that gift.
My pleasure. I loved that review.
You make it clear early on that the science of learning is not figured out, and you didn't even try, but you've got some pretty good starting points here. Why did you start to hit this topic?
Well, my job is as a reporter on psychology and psychiatry and brain science, and one of the big areas of psychology is cognitive psychology, which is the study of learning and memory, essentially, learning, memory, and thinking. I began to write stories about this field, which does some really interesting direct studies of, you know, what kinds of things affect learning and memory. Simple things, like where you are and if you're moving around or sitting still, the way you engage the material, you know, how you work with it, all sorts of stuff. And I realized that not many people knew this stuff, so I thought it would make a great book.
And one of the main tenets of it is that forgetting is almost as important as learning. Is learning to remember more important than actually learning?
It's a combination of things. Forgetting, it turns out, is very important to learning in that when we learn new stuff, in effect, we sort of move into the background some of the things that we already know. So if we couldn't do that, we couldn't learn, you know, the new material. But that doesn't go away. It's still accessible. And so if we need it again, we're able through, you know, several techniques that I describe in here sort of to get it back. But if you can't forget things, if you can't essentially suppress particularly related memories, you can't learn anything new. your brain doesn't have, you can only access a certain finite amount of information at any one time.
You also take that old theory about you need a nice, quiet place to study with no distractions and pretty much blow that up in the book.
That's right. That's sort of folk wisdom, and it seems self-evident that a quiet place and a study ritual, avoiding distractions, all those things would be important to learning. It turns out none of those are true. There is no one ideal way to learn. In fact, the brain kind of grew up, sort of evolutionarily speaking, learning on the fly, you know, out in the open, not in a classroom. And so the trick is to kind of exploit some of those scavenging habits that are really more natural than the, you know, the very sort of disciplined monk-like ideal that's held up.
Those distractions are almost natural. Now, in the book, you have a little a scene where you had to go finish a newspaper story and you took your young daughter with you, and she observed you doing your work. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I did. I brought her into the office on a weekend. You know, the two of us were the only ones here. And I set her down at a computer thinking she would, you know, hop online and get busy. And it looks like it's exactly what she did. And I went to finish a story, and I went into deep concentration, or so I thought. And it was only afterwards, after about an hour and a half or so, that I finished. And I tapped her on the shoulder, and she handed me what was a second-by-second record that she'd been typing of my behavior. And there were a whole lot of things in there, Bob, that I didn't remember doing. I called a friend. I went up and made coffee. You know, I was pulling out stuff from the drawers. I was walking around, sort of mumbling to myself. I thought I'd been concentrating the whole time. And so it was a good illustration of just the principle that, you know, concentration is held up as this kind of, again, an ideal of learning, does not necessarily look like what we think it does. Even when we're very highly concentrated, we are also kind of giving ourselves breaks, and we can be very restless looking to an outside person. So it's just a kind of a demonstration that some of the assumptions we make about ideal learning circumstances aren't based in reality.
And learning is pretty much like that. As you say in the book, your brain really needs those breaks from learning to actually learn.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. Yeah, I mean, I think it's one thing if you're jumping on the phone and, you know, Snapchatting, you know, all the way through a college lecture or a, you know, high school lecture. I mean, you're not going to retain anything. Obviously, that's a problem. But to the extent that you're taking distractions when you need a break from something you're working on that does not require continuous attention, you know, like a math problem or you're doing a term paper, those can help you out. And it's not just because you're getting a break or a rest so much as that the brain works offline on a lot of these problems. And particularly when you're stuck, distraction allows you to, in effect, forget some of the, you know, assumptions you made that blocked you the first time through. And the result is that, you know, when you come back, it's not a matter necessarily of being more rested, but that, you know, you've let go of some bad assumptions and you're able to take a sort of a fresh look at the problem.
And sometimes you say you're learning and you're not even realizing it at the time. Your brain just seems to be working in the background.
That's right. In the example I just gave you there, there is a lot of evidence that that's precisely what's happening, that it is working on the problem essentially without you consciously looking over its shoulder. The brain is reorganizing the material in new ways outside your consciousness. So, you know, when you come back to directly look at the problem, in effect, mentally, the representation of the problem has changed, and you've increased the likelihood you can solve it.
You write about the work of Graham Wallace in the book. Why was his work, do you feel that was important?
Yeah, Graham Wallace was an interesting character. He's an English sort of early 20th century theorist and teacher, education policy person, famous socialist too. Anyway, he was the first one, Bob, who really provided, you know, the language, the vocabulary to talk about stages of thinking, and particularly problem solving. And it was his language, and particularly his identification of something called incubation, which is that downtime period between, you know, when you're stuck on a problem and when you say, oh, God, you know, I see it now, that really launched a bunch of really interesting study into just that process. You know, what's going on? What makes it more likely to happen? And, you know, how can it be used by people? You know, how can you take advantage of it? That kind of thing.
You talk about the importance of sleep, calling it learning with your eyes closed. How important is sleep?
Sleep is very important to learning. I think people suspect this. They maybe know this. We all have instincts about these things. But it's a more interesting story than it looks. Sleep is, at least in one very sort of leading theory, is all about learning consolidation. And that just means that, you know, we see and hear and study a lot of things over the course of a day, way more than we're going to hang on to. And a primary function of sleep is to flag the stuff that's meaningful and hold on to it and get rid of the rest. So 99.9 of the sort of 9% of what we see and hear, what comes through our senses is discarded. And during sleep, according to this theory, you hang on to the good stuff, essentially. But, you know, we sometimes think of sleep as almost a sign of weakness, that we're giving up on studying or working out. It turns out that's just opposite the case. It finishes the job of learning.
Well, we all know that, you know, waking up at 3 in the morning going, ah, that's what I was trying to remember.
Yeah, but it's more even than that. In fact, the study of sleep and learning has found, for example, that the first half of a night's sleep, a normal night's sleep, is rich in what's called deep sleep, and that's important for retention, straight retention. So if you don't get that first half of the night's sleep, your retention level goes down. Okay, so that's important information if you're preparing, for example, for a French test or an Arabic test, for a test where you really are going to be assessed on your ability to recall, straight recall. You need to get that first half of your normal night's sleep and not cut into it. So you can see that, for example, that in this example, that staying up late is not a particularly good idea because you are biting a piece off of the retention consolidation part of sleep. So for an exam like that, you should go to bed the normal time, and if you're going to shorten your night, you should get up early and prepare. So that's an example, Bob, of how the study can kind of help you be tactical in the way that you use your study time.
Still to come, our conversation with New York Times science reporter Benedict Carey continues with a look at some puzzles and problems that might just help. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Benedict Carey, a science reporter for The New York Times. We're talking about his book, How We Learn, The Surprising Truth About When, Where, and Why It Happens.
I did want to let you know that I did feel very good about myself when I figured out the pencil problem.
Did you?
I did. Oh, yes. It actually didn't take all that long.
That is a great problem, and it's an old problem. Yeah, and so the book's got a few of those, and they're good demonstrations, I think, of the way that some of this incubation time can work in your favor, offline thinking while you're being distracted.
Well, incubation, I thought was one of the better things that you brought up in the book because of, well, you mentioned some people get their ideas in the toilet. I get them in the shower. Man, we all get these ideas when we're really not even trying to come up with them.
That's right, and I think the reason is, you know, as I mentioned before, that a lot of the times when you're stuck, what's happened is not so much, you know, you're not smart enough to handle the problem, but that you've made assumptions about the solution without knowing you've made those assumptions. I mean, the example I give in the book is there's a joke or a puzzle or riddle. You can still get people stuck on this. There's a doctor in Chicago who has a brother who's a doctor in Boston, but the doctor in Boston does not have a brother. How can that be? And that was the joke or a puzzle sort of told more often in my parents' day. And, of course, the one in Chicago is a female doctor. But you can trick people with that by saying fiddler, boxer, whatever, today. And the point there is not that, you know, you or I aren't capable of seeing a solution. It's that our brains have made an assumption. That's what makes that a puzzle. And so what incubation is describing, that is, you're distracted, you're offline, you're doing something else. Your brain hasn't let go of the problems, but it is able to let go of some of those assumptions. It's once you do that that you really sort of see a much clearer way to a solution.
There's an awful lot of great information in this book. What can teachers do with this to make their job a little easier or a little more effective?
Well, teaching and learning are two different things, and they do overlap, of course, and I think teachers have really good instincts about a lot of this stuff. But I'll tell you what, I think the best way to use this material is to teach it directly. The classroom situations are very different from individual learning situations. Teachers know this too well. And so you can't really tailor this information necessarily to every single classroom. But you can teach the techniques directly to kids. In fact, that makes for a really interesting and useful brain science class. My sort of shtick on this now, Bob, is to say, let's just teach it directly for now. Schools already teach some organizational skills and how to be a student. This is a perfect place to teach direct the science of learning, and sort of learning 101, call it what you like. But teachers and schools will incorporate some of these things, and they already are. But some of them will not incorporate the classrooms easily. These are individual learning techniques, and as I say, they should be taught directly, and kids, I think, can have a lot of fun with them. Once you know them, it makes a lot of studying or preparing or practicing, it can make it much less dreary than it is.
So it can make life easier for students, if not teachers.
For sure. I mean, the first thing it does is it takes stress out of trying to live up to an ideal student because, you know, it ain't ideal. Not the one description we've been given. But it also, more importantly, I think for students of all kinds and all ages, and this applies to all ages, it gives you a way to make a strategy. You know, you can take the science of learning 101, there's about 10 different techniques, and you can choose the ones that apply to, you know, the material you're trying to learn that particular week or month or whatever it is. I mean, you do certain things preparing for language tests, and you do other things for math tests, and still other things preparing for, let's say, a recital or even, for that matter, you know, a soccer game. So we never get techniques. No one ever gets learning 101 as a class. We grow up just hoping we're doing it right. What this science does is give you, at least give you some idea of how to approach learning particular material, how to use your time. So I think it's powerful stuff.
You close the book with the 11 essential questions. First of all, why 11? And second of all, are these is this kind of the sum of what you're trying to get out to people?
Yes, I put 11 questions. I don't the number of questions itself is meaningless. I don't know. It just came out to be 11. I wanted to cover in those 11 questions some very central points, but also use them as a teaser for people to, you know, wonder why, for example, distractions can help in some situations, or wonder why in some situations the more we get tested, the better we do, even though we haven't restudied, right? Or wonder why highlighting, which is something I did, I'm sure you did, so many of us did, is not a good idea, is not a good study technique. In fact, can get in the way and be a limiting thing. So a lot of the techniques found in this science are counterintuitive, and those 11 questions kind of are fun to do. They're multiple choice, and also I think make people wonder, well, why would this be true? Why would these things be kind of the opposite of what I expect? And once you see the science, it's pretty straightforward.
Again, the name of Benedict Carey's book is How We Learn, The Surprising Truth About When, Where, and Why It Happens. Where are you from? Because of her skin tone and features, Malani Chatterjee Lynn gets asked this question all the time. Her answer, ordinary and surprising at the same time, says something about what it means to be an American.
Where are you from? I can't tell you how many times I've been asked this question. At school, at work, traveling abroad, and even in public bathrooms. But no, like, where are you really from? I've seen others get upset when people approach them like this. I can understand the question, though. My features don't give away any particular ethnicity. I have dark, almond-shaped eyes. My skin tone is best described as olive. I have black hair that falls straight down, and a sort of pointed nose. I'm a little shorter than average height and wear college clothes. I actually enjoy getting asked this. Maybe it's because I like to make people uncomfortable. The pause on their face when I ask what they mean is satisfying. Watching their heads tilt slightly, eyes focused on my face as if they can decode my ethnicity if they stare hard enough, can be pretty amusing. All jokes aside, my favorite part about getting asked this question is answering it. I've had so many people guess. ¿Eres mexicana? No, pero puedo hablar en español. Are you Thai? No, but that's close, sort of. Hawaiian? I wish. Maybe Indian? Like the native type? Or like actually Indian? I've even had people tell me that I must be from their country somehow, because I look like their people. I'm still waiting on that fateful day when someone says, "Oh, that's a no-brainer. You must be half Indian and half Chinese." Really, that's just part of the answer. If I'm answering honestly, I would give a pretty unsatisfying response. I was born in Berkeley, California, and grew up in Bethesda, Maryland. When that doesn't satisfy people, they ask about my parents. Surely they'll get an interesting answer then. Not. My mom is from upstate New York, and my dad's from Chelmsford, Massachusetts. It doesn't get interesting until you get to my grandparents. My mom's parents were born in West Bengal, India. My dad's dad was born in Portland, Maine, and his parents were born in southern China. My grandma was also born in southern China. All of my relatives came to the U.S. for better opportunities, and they were lucky enough to find them. Not without hard work. So, what's the big deal? I'll admit, I think it's pretty cool that I'm half Indian and half Chinese. There aren't that many of us. In fact, I don't know anyone with an Indian mother and a Chinese father besides myself and my younger sisters. Plus, I can blend in a lot of places. When I travel to India or Mexico, nobody looks at me funny, so long as I don't say anything to betray my ordinary American accent. It can be fun to see how long I can last without blowing my cover as a native. I can also participate in Indian and Chinese cultural events without being an outsider, which is awesome because the more holidays and delicious food, the better. But in the end, I make people realize that looks can be deceiving. My facial features and skin tone would suggest to some people that I'm not American. However, I grew up learning only English until middle school when I took Spanish, like your average American kid. My parents speak almost exactly how I do. I had turkey and cheese sandwiches with an apple for lunch every day for most of my childhood. I went to day camp during the summer, took vacations to the beach, and visited my cousins and grandparents in New York and California. And I grew up in suburbia, in a very white, somewhat Jewish, and highly educated area outside of D.C. I think it's important to take a step back and think about what it really means to be American. Maybe it's a cliche question, but it's worth thinking about. Almost everyone has at least a great-great-grandparent who was born in another country, whether they know where they are from or not. And many people who are from the U.S. are bilingual and not of European descent. In the end, all of these people asking me where I am from are basically just as American, or maybe as un-American, as I am.
Malani Chatterjee Lenn is a student living in Cambridge, Massachusetts. So you gotta believe anyone who has taken a long road trip has stayed in a mom-and-pop roadside motel sometime in their life. However, these little bits of Americana are disappearing, and that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
We're losing part of our history. I am Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Andrew Wood, professor of communication studies at San Jose State University, details a small part of Americana that's becoming a thing of the past.
The mom-and-pop motel, which saw its heyday in the mid-20th century, continues its hold on the American imagination. Of course, when we speak of motel, a combination of motor and hotel, a word coined in California, of course, we don't refer to the downtown hotels with their rituals of check-in and baggage delivery, but rather to the more car-friendly motor lodges that wait languidly along the highways and byways of the nation. Today, one may find motels in literary or cinematic depictions of highway drama, escape, and sometimes terror. But fewer motorists seek them out. Mark Okrant states that approximately 16,000 motels were operating in 2012. That's a decline from their zenith of 61,000 in 1964. And in the past 4 years, that number has declined further. Even so, efforts to preserve mom-and-pop motor lodges offer hope for a motel resurgence. A growing number of preservation societies and intrepid cultural explorers have begun to hit the exits and travel the highways again in search of that one singular experience just around the bend. You could argue that the decline of mom-and-pop motels signifies something else lost in contemporary American life, the loss of friction, of distance, of idiosyncrasy, and a related fantasy that one may gather up all the world, all the same and dependable parts of it at least, and navigate its safe interiors without fear of surprise. There is pleasure and some degree of satisfaction in this fantasy, but we might imagine motor lodges, those of the past and those that remain today, as a necessary departure from the script of everyday life, a place where travelers can still invent a new persona, a new past, a new destination.
That was Andrew Wood of San Jose State University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.